Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I am Donna Priskintas.
Here we are at the community radio station, KHOI, in beautiful downtown Ames.
It is safely out of the boiling heat.
Oh, it was a windy and warm weekend.
Well, I was glad for the wind. At least it kept it moving.
My goodness, it has kind of blown us into summer.
It's like a good whack over the head.
I must say that Farmer's Market on Saturday morning was very interesting. I mean, we're farmers. We're used to being outside. We've got our tents
up.
Right,
this is Iowa in the summer.
What do you expect? It's fine. It starts out beautiful. Okay, it gets warmer. But then the wind starts, and I hear down the street, crash, tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. Down the street the other way, crash, tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. The wind was strong enough that it picked up some of those actually well-anchored tents and kind of strewn things all over Main Street.
Well, so, we got to have some dramatic action occasionally,
gosh.
You know.
So if you want an exciting time, come to a farmer's market during a windstorm. Not everybody had that problem, but it was enough that kept people on their toes.
Lively.
Oh, boy. So, today we're going to be talking about grilling, strawberries, Father's Day, and talk about a summer's day a little later. Yes, about first, a few words about strawberries. This past weekend was the full moon, so all of you who are in the lunatic sort of bend, I bet you were out there raising a glass to the full moon.
It was a beauty.
It was lovely. And it is traditionally called the strawberry moon.
In fact, I was out looking at the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I finally saw a few fireflies, just a few, and the mosquitoes are not too bad yet.
Not yet. Oh, that's right. The fireflies are pretty dandy. Anyway, here's a little bit about strawberries. I mean, we'll think about that. It's from a little reading from the Food Lover's Companion, Comprehensive Definitions of Nearly 6,000 Food, Drink, and Culinary Terms Under Strawberries. It says, 16th century author William Butler wrote this tribute to the strawberry. Doubtless God could have made a better berry, but doubtless God ever did. Ah, yes.
Well, ultimately, that's true. Although I must say, the commercial strawberries that we now often eat are only slightly left of cardboard.
They've gone through quite a transition. The most common.
They look nice.
Yeah, American variety is the result of several centuries of crossbreeding of the wild Virginia strawberry, North America's main native strawberry, and a Chilean variety. So I think they're still tinkering with that. Yeah.
Oh, yes. They're breeding for shelf stability and long life.
They've made it hardy. They've made it able to withstand shipping and storage.
So, which is a good reason to buy local strawberries.
Yes, yes.
Of which I am sad to announce
that the season
is just about, it's closing. We called Judy Henry out at the Berry Patch for our strawberry report. The heat has done them in. End of the strawberry season. However, Judy did say, within 2 weeks, we will have the Montmorency pie cherries,
mm-hmm.
Which are a lovely Iowa treat, and then followed by blueberries. So let's move right along into the berry beautiful summer.
Well, it's summer, warm weather. We're kind of moving our thoughts outside here. In a past show, Don and I talked about picnics and eating outside, and we looked at each other and said, I don't know that much about grilling, or I'd rather not grill. What about you? And
Donna said, this is our Father's Day show in honor of all the masculine culinary traits, and the most cliched one is grilling. I mean, I can grill, but we got two big boys in the studio with us today to talk about grilling, Evan and Nick.
Yes, Nick Odie from Practical Farmers of Iowa and Evan Taylor, man of many traits. He's our excellent engineer, but also knows his way around the kitchen.
So we're going to get some opinions. So we started off with the – we've already been talking about this. I dropped by Cook's Emporium this morning to kind of look at their grilling gear and Father's Day gifts, and they had this really cute little maybe not quite 2-inch stick-in-the-meat thermometer. I call it thermometer for dummies because it had not only the temperatures for the grilling, but it was marked at medium rare – rare, medium well, and well done in case you don't know your numbers. So what do you do, Nick, to tell whether the steak is what you want?
So I do use a thermometer. It's kind of like using the thermometer to train the poke method. So, you know, once I've done that, oh.
That's,
you know,
the poke with the fingers. Like I stick my flat thumb on it. Right.
Yep. Poke the meat and it feels kind of soft. It's not done as it firms up. It's getting closer to done. And I use a thermometer to kind of like train that touch, you know.
See, I'm so old that I can do it without the thermometer. I'm trained.
Evan, did you use a thermometer or your eyes or what?
I'm more of a fan of the poke method as well.
Poke method.
If you just if you use kind of the padding at the base of your thumb a bit of a guideline, that's a good way of doing it.
Feel, when you poke it, if it feels like it's called the mound of Venus on your thumb. Mm-hmm. If it feels like that, you are at medium rare.
Really?
That's right. When you have your hand just flat, you poke the padding of your thumb. It's supposed to be sort of rare, raw. If you touch the tip of your index finger to the tip of your thumb and touch it again, then it's kind of a medium rare. Middle finger to the tip of the thumb is a bit of a medium, and then so on down the line through medium well and then well done.
Don't let it get that far.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Oh no!
Absolutely.
I mean, don't ever let it get that far.
In agreement about that. Sorry, I mean, for you folks that like your steaks well done.
Yep, it's a great way to ruin your meat, that's for sure, especially when you take into account that even after you take it off the heat, it's going to continue cooking a little
that's
bit while
right.
it sits.
That's
so, I
right.
mean, if anything, err on the side of a little bit less done than you'd like it.
Yes, because if it's too rare, you can always put it back on. Once it's overcooked, you have blown it.
That's right. You've ruined your grill out.
Now at Cook's Emporium, they had all kinds of fancy skewers also for – and vegetable baskets and all kinds of things to set on the grill. Nick, what else do you like to grill besides steaks and brats?
Well, that's pretty much fish also, but mainly – I'm mainly a meat griller. I haven't done too much with vegetables. My dad likes to do the vegetable thing for like a fajitas with onions and peppers and that kind of thing.
That's
in a grill basket.
That's always nice. Yeah. Hey, peppers are good on grill because you get that char, the little char flavor. What about you, Evan?
I also used to do just about meats exclusively, but I've recently been branching out more into veggies. One of my personal favorites is taking some fresh Brussels sprouts and quartering them and tossing in salt, pepper, olive oil, maybe like some thinly sliced bacon, maybe some other goodies,
bacon
depending on what
good.
You're thinking about. Put it in a foil pouch and then set that on the grill for quite a while, usually in the cold zone of the grill so that you can have it sit there and cook low and slow for a little bit. I did that at Thanksgiving, actually, this past year, and that was a crowd pleaser with the family.
You know, I saw something at Fairway in their meat case, which I thought was a good idea. I haven't done it, but they took a little roll of asparagus, maybe, slightly under 2 mm-hmm. inches rolled, and then they mm-hmm. wrapped it in the whole middle part in bacon, mm-hmm. and they've got that all ready to go for the grill, too.
Oh,
I mean,
there you go. That's a good one. I mean, sweet corn is always a classic to do on the grill.
Now, okay, do you do it in the husk or not in the husk?
Sort of depends on how much time I have on my hands that day. If I have plenty of time, I do it in the husk because you need to soak the husks before you toss it on the grill or else you're just going to burn the husk and ruin your corn. If I have a little bit less time, though, I'll actually take it out of the husk and put it in foil with salt, pepper, butter, and then whatever other goodies I feel like doing it with.
I like to just spray them with olive oil spray mm-hmm. and a little salt and pepper and throw them right on the grill. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to be quick about that
right.
and turn them because you can easily overcook them and then they're just like dry and chewy. But
right.
if you get it right, you just get enough of that charcoal flavor on it and then they pop right when you sink your
definitely.
Teeth into.
Plus, you have some gorgeous char marks that you can get on them.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What about you, Nick? Do you do corn?
Yeah, I kind of in the husk. What I've been doing recently is a lot of his brats, because we just made a bunch of brats.
Nick makes his own brats. Oh boy.
I started kind of making those with my dad out of necessity, because because
they're hunters.
Right. So we have a lot of venison, and that's one thing you can do with venison, and that's
so
the only
what,
way you
what
can
do you
make
put
them.
In for fat?
When we make venison, that would work too. When we make venison brats, we put about 25% to 30% pork shoulder, probably, and so kind of a fatty cut, so that it works. But the main thing about making a brat or any sausage successful, maybe even more so than the fat, is salting the meat before you make that. So we'll salt
that
overnight.
Pull the juices out a little bit, so it's not. What does it do?
Yeah. So what it does is actually it traps in more of the juices when you cook it, which is kind of counterintuitive. But what actually happens is when you first salt it, it pulls a little bit out, but then it creates it kind of stabilizes
the
water
cells or
in
something.
There.
Yeah.
And it also makes the surface kind of tacky of the meat. So if you think about all the meat in a bowl.
Do you grind it first, grind it and salt it, and then let it sit?
So you salt, cut it into chunks that are big enough to put in the grinder.
Okay.
Salt it at least overnight, maybe up to 24 hours, and then grind it. And then kind of mix it up with your hands, and it has that tacky, kind of sticky texture to it that's a lot different than actually ground beef.
Mm-hmm.
And what that's just, it's creating actually similar to the tackiness and stickiness of gluten, and it's actually creating kind of a binding in there when you cook it. So,
but there's no grains in it, right?
No grains or anything, but the protein is similar to a gluten type protein. So when mm-hmm. you bite into a brat, it has some bounce to it. It doesn't just fall apart, as mm-hmm. opposed to a burger, which you kind of want. It doesn't have that same bounce, and it's because of that salting in there that gives it that
bounce.
Now,
you're stuffing them into casings.
Yep.
The whole thing, okay.
Right, but that bounce will happen regardless of whether it's breakfast sausage that you free form or if you stuff it into casings.
And give us a little hint of how you season your venison and pork brats.
Yeah, so I've made both, and it's pretty similar, but the main thing that's different is that there's marjoram and a little bit of nutmeg in there. I think that's what kind of gives it its broadiness.
Oh, I think marjoram is a must.
Yep. Oh, that's the taste.
Ah,
marjoram, okay.
So, and really...
pepper, of course.
And there's pepper, and depending on the brat, there might be garlic, might be some other, something like allspice or one of those other different. But I think any time I eat marjoram when it's in something else, I always think brats, because that's probably the only thing I ate when I was growing up that had marjoram in it.
Ah, that's that taste. Okay, that tastes like a brat.
I have to say marjoram. Actually, and I use dried. It's one of the herbs I use dried, because if you ever grew it yourself and pick off one little leaf at a time, it's really annoying. And it dries pretty well.
Yeah.
But, and I use marjoram by the fistful in everything. It's my favorite herb. It's called sweet marjoram.
Good.
Yeah.
Nick, talk more about casings. Brats have a shape.
And guys, realize when you're eating sausages, you're getting casings.
That's right. So we, to make brats, used hog casings.
They're called natural casings.
Right? Natural casings. So you can have casings that are made of other things. But
lamb
the hog casings
is a common one, too.
Are made of hog intestine. Mm-hmm. And so the traditional sausages are made with different casings from different animals. So it's basically different intestines from different animals. The bigger, thicker salamis are from a beef, from a cow.
Ah.
The kind of smaller, slimmer ones are probably from a sheep. And then this, what you think of as like a brat or an Italian sausage, that's going to be from a pig.
Ha! Huh. And you can, as you are butchering a hog, you can harvest the intestines, and are they ready to go? You have to clean them
out. Explain the process.
Yeah, how do you?
So I haven't ever done that. I've always bought casings, and they're usually cured in salt, and then you soak them to rehydrate them. But obviously someone at some point has done that, and the traditional way was to run water through them. And I think I've always read that was something that was fun for kids to do, to take part in the hog butchering process, like blowing water through that intestine.
So what did they do? Squeeze the guts out and then run water through it?
Yeah. So, well, ideally, I mean, if you're going to do the whole process from butchering, from killing the animal to butchering, you can actually withhold feed the day before you butcher the animal. And so the intestines don't have anything in them.
Not much.
I mean, you still have to clean it, but it doesn't have a whole bunch of stuff in them. And so.
And when you buy them, what kind of length do they come in? A couple feet?
Oh, they're usually maybe like 4 or 5 feet,
oh, really?
Something like
oh,
that.
Oh, my goodness. Whole thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well.
Well, how many feet of running feet do you think you get per pig when you're butchering?
I'm not sure, but it's a lot. I mean, there's I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it's tens of feet. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
But we will have to research that one. I will call Story City and see. Get some experienced opinions on that.
So the tradition, or how you make this, is that you put stuff in a grinder. How do you get it from the grinder into the casings?
So that is a really hard part if
you
were doing it by hand.
Oh, no. You don't do it by hand. Doesn't your grinder have a stuffer? It's called a stuffer.
Exactly. We have a separate sausage stuffer that kind of creates a vacuum and pushes the meat into those casings. You put the casing kind of on the end, and then you just press
thread the casing on.
Exactly. Otherwise, it does take a very long time. You have to have some kind of a funnel, and you kind of push it in, and you end up with air pockets. And it would be a very long process if you do it by hand, but people obviously did that for thousands of years.
I think my grinder has a stuffer attachment.
Yeah, and many grinders do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when you get the proper length, what, you tie a little bow in it or what?
Yeah, it's kind of a continuous process. The meat's, you're feeding the meat out of the stuffer and into the casing, and when you get to the right length, you make a little twist, and so then you end up with this big long link like you'd see hanging in an Italian butcher shop of something.
There we go.
All these different links.
It's a beautiful thing.
There you go. And when you're making brats, do they have to, like, age, or are they good to go on the grill right away?
They're good to go on the grill right away. In fact, I cooked a lot up that first day. And I will say,
Lana,
that
where were we? How did we miss this? You must have smelled it.
It was lovely.
And I will also say that in brats, and I make this mistake a lot in grilling, is that I put them directly on the heat, right? And they end up bursting. Because they get too hot.
And they're really juicy. Yeah.
And they're really juicy, and all that liquid expands and it pops the casing. And then the whole idea of the nice, juicy, kind of bouncy brat is ruined. And so what I've learned to do is cook them slow until they're almost done and then put it over to the hot side of the grill and get the nice sear marks.
Ah. Yes. Yeah, see, these are grilling tricks.
So then you can't use a thermometer? Or how do you tell when it's done
on
the inside? How do you know when it's done in the inside?
Don't you poke them with your finger too?
Yeah, in that case, but you can use a thermometer. You don't want to poke it too many times, but it's not that much liquid can get out that one hole. Just unless it's really hot, and then you probably made the mistake anyway, and you're probably going to break the casing.
Yes, and there's this other method. That's allowed the grill master, right? You just pull one off and you cut the end off and you just keep eating it till you know it's right.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, yes. Privileges.
Do you make any other kind of sausage besides brats?
Yeah, so we've done, and the basic process is pretty much identical, but we've done kielbasa, the standard Polish sausage, which is
so it's smoked. Just a difference in flavor.
Yep.
Oh, and then you smoke them, or do you smoke paprika?
So for the Polish sausage, for example, I did you make it the same way and then smoke the sausage. And I haven't done this, but, of course, you could also dry cure sausages, so many of the Italian sausages
are
dry cured.
Oh, that means, like, hang them up above your bed, right?
Yeah, if your bed's the right temperature.
Yeah, got to control for humidity and temperature.
Okay.
They used to hang them in the chimney, didn't they?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, that was a way to cure, because usually the bricks kept the temperature a certain way, and then you get the smoky flavor. This was only not when you're using the chimney.
Oh, okay.
You know, like summer storing or something. I don't know, something like that.
We'll figure it out. There's so many things to think about when you light up that grill. We're talking grilling here with Evan Taylor and Nick Odey. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a little bit of the Cotton Patch Rag by banjo player Alan Munth with a bunch of other folks jumping in there, too. We are in the kitchen talking about cooking outside of the kitchen. We're talking about grilling today, thinking of getting on that patio.
Yep, this is our Father's Day grilling show.
Yeah, think about all those good old dads out there and guys putting
dads
things
in
out there.
Training here.
What's nice is that picnics and grilling, I can be sitting there watching somebody else do it.
Sipping my wine cooler and letting the guy stand over the hot fire.
It's so much fun. Right? It's so much fun. We're here with Nick Odey and Evan Taylor. So let's talk fire here. What kind of grills do you guys use?
Fortunately, we've got two examples, and Evan does the wood and charcoal, and Nick does the gas. So, Evan, tell us about your grilling situation and what you can do with it.
Okay, well, you know, I typically like to go with the kind of standard Weber kettle grill, just sort of the most basic charcoal grill out there on the market.
A very modest investment, but a good toy.
Hey, absolutely. I think it's easier for me to do in the sense that, you know, when I was growing up and grilling with my dad in the backyard, seemingly every weekend, sometimes multiple times a week when I was growing up at the parents' house, that's what he had, so that's what I learned on. Always the good way of doing it.
It's the old-fashioned. Lots of people are too lazy to start the fire these days.
Right. Well, I mean, that's one of the good things, though, is they make little handy-dandy tools. Like you have a chimney charcoal starter, which is one of my personal favorites. It's kind of a cylinder of metal with a grate about three quarters of the way down that you put all of your charcoal in. And then in the bottom corner, you put in, newspaper or any other sort of kindling that you want to use. Newspapers always work best
for me. So you can avoid that nasty fire starter product?
Oh, that's right. I absolutely cannot stand
the
lighter fluid
stuff. You can get that on your food,
stuff.
And it is a disaster.
Oh, it just tastes gross. Whereas this
smells
is
gross,
much easier way to get everything started and helps you do it in a pretty timely manner as well.
And won't set yourself on fire either.
Hey, that too. Won't set yourself or your neighbors on fire. So that's always kind of a plus. One of the things I like about that is that, once you do have those coals nice and lit, you have your a nice kind of surface ashy layer to
now,
all of the coals.
Now, do you have any wisdom about briquettes or what kind of charcoal you use or anything? I mean, there's a lot of products out there.
Oh, there are a lot of products. I usually just go with a briquette style charcoal preferably one that has like a mesquite or a hickory in it. That's what they, that's one of the cool things that they have on the product, the market right now is they have those little wood chips in there to give you a little bit of extra flavor if you don't have the time to go and find some of your own and, you know, soak them and make them useful for you.
So you are a fan of wood chips too, though. So
I am a fan of wood chips.
Explain how you do it.
Yeah, so what I like to do with the wood chips is actually soak them a little bit, a couple hours before the grilling. I like mesquite a lot. I like the flavor of the smoke that it imparts when you add it to the charcoal. But yeah, I soak it for a little bit, and then when the coals are nice and lit, mix it in, and that way the mesquite isn't necessarily hot enough that's just going to burn right up, but it will give a nice smoke to whatever meat you do have on your grill at the time. I guess another thing that I like about the charcoal grills is it's pretty easy to establish kind of a your hot zones and your cool zones.
Do you keep your charcoal in a pile then?
Start it out in a pile, but then kind of spread it in such a way that there's a little bit of a larger concentration on one side of the grill than the other. That way the entire grill itself is hot, but then you have a zone of your grill that's significantly hotter that's going to help you with grilling items such as like steaks that don't need to be put on for quite as long.
Steaks at room temperature?
I do start my steaks at room temperature. That's right. Whereas, you know, having the cool side is better for like veggies and chicken. That way you can have them on there for quite a while without overdoing it. And then move them to the hot side at the very end to get those sear marks that Nick and I keep on bringing up. But yeah, I do like the charcoal. It's something about, I don't know, the romanticism of actually cooking around like a fire and having to kind of work for it that I enjoy. It's not necessarily convenient, but it's fun.
No, but it also is a skill set that we're kind of losing to really understand how fire works. I mean, both Lana and I have wood stoves during the winter, but otherwise most people forget how to build fires really reliably, and they also forget how to cook with fires. I mean, you got to remember that probably your great-grandmother had nothing but a wood stove, possibly. And it's a very interesting skill set, so good for you to do that.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly comes in handy when you go camping and such. You know, you can't exactly take your propane grill out with you.
No, and you look like an idiot if you don't know how to start a fire. I gotta say, that's, you know. So, now, Nick, you have the push-the-button grill.
That's right. As I was saying with the oven meat thermometer, I really like the ability to have all the control in the world over the temperature, and I think that I can do that with the gas grill. I use a charcoal grill sometimes, but vast majority of the time I just...
Last year he cooked a whole lamb out on a rather elaborate wood pile, right? That's a whole nother grilling experience.
Yeah, and I can take credit for the butchering of the lamb, but the cooking was... That was beyond my area of experience. Anyway.
Yeah, that took some skill.
It was pretty picturesque. So Gio did it. Who else did it?
It was mainly him. He was the brains behind that.
Yeah, he's our local Georgian from the country Georgia. We'll have to have Gio on talking about some of his fire skill sets. But so, in your gas grill, how do you get control over it? Do you have one set of burners that you do lower? What do you do?
Yeah, so there's three burners next to each
with
other.
With three different controls.
Right, exactly.
Oh, okay.
And so usually I'll turn two on and leave one off unless I'm doing steaks that I just need to cook really fast. But turn two on and leave one off, sear it on that hot side, and then move it over to the cool side to let it cook slowly, come up to temperature a little bit more slowly.
And does yours have a lid that you can kind of close and control that?
Yeah.
Explain how you use that.
Well, so when you open the lid, there's more oxygen flowing through there. So when you close the lid, you kind of, you can trap some heat, but you also suppress the oxygen. So you're preventing things like flare-ups when you put that lid on there.
Good. You mentioned before cooking fish seems a delicate thing to be cooking on fire. How do you do that?
Yeah, so what I mean, it depends on the fish. You can get it directly in the grill.
Right.
But what – and I don't cook nearly as much fish as my dad. My parents live in northeast Iowa, so there's trout up there. So they cook a lot of trout.
Trout on the grill.
On the grill.
Ooh.
Yeah.
He must be very skilled.
A lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
But so I always cook – when I grill fish, I do them in a foil, in foil,
mm-hmm.
And a little bit of liquid.
Foolproof, but you don't get the – I used to do – a lot of salmon on the grill. Of course, you start skin side down. That definitely helps. But with trout's pretty delicate.
With salmon on the grill, you don't put it in foil?
I didn't.
And you put it skin side down. Do you ever flip it over or just cook
I mean, once you put it skin side down, of course, it will start to firm so you can – I mean, if you have a good – now, this is the other thing, especially with the gas grill, to whatever the surface of the grill is made out of. So I had a cast iron one that eventually gets pretty well – you know, all you do is scrape it with a brush and get the gunk off. But the cast iron itself gets pretty seasoned, so you're not what's yours made out of?
Yeah, I don't know if it's cast iron, but it's pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
which is really good for heat retention.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, let it heat up for 5 or 10 minutes and then scrape it because you can get some of that, you know, the last time's cooking off of it a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Rub a little oil on there to kind of
Keep seasoning it.
Keep seasoning it, exactly. And then, yeah, like you're saying, if it's a little heavier, it can get a little bit better sear, and that actually makes it stick less when you get that good sear,
right?
Because it cooks that surface instead of adhering.
Yeah.
It's kind of like cooking an omelet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nick, I know you do a lot of wild game. Is wild game tricky to cook on a grill?
It is, and I think that's a big reason why.
Because it doesn't have fat, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah. It depends on the wild game, but yeah, if we're talking about deer, there's no marbling in the meat, so. I think that's a big reason why people don't like wild game. So if you think about probably pheasant breasts and deer steaks are two of the more common things that people are probably cooking. They're both really lean.
Well, and you could ruin them really easily too. Right?
Yeah, deer, it's kind of like beef tenderloin. It's not really any good when it gets past medium rare, medium at most. It's really got to be cooked that way for it to be good. And you can go from medium rare to well done very quickly.
In the blink of an eye.
You also mentioned smoking. Now, smoking is a whole different contraption than a grill, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so some grills, and like Evan was talking about, you can get a little bit of smoke on the grill by putting some soaked wood chips in there to get smoke in there.
And then you slap the lid on, right? Yep.
Right. So, and I've done a little bit of smoking, but I just have an old kind of hand-me-down smoker that's got a electric heating element that looks like the bottom of your electric oven in the bottom.
And how's that work? I've read about those.
So you just put soaked wood chips in the bottom, and then that heats that pulls the smoke out of like the green soaked wood chips. They don't burn because they're green and soaked. And then there's racks above it, and the smoke comes up through there. You can't really control temperature very well, but if you're smoking something that you don't need it to be on there for hours and hours, it works fine. So I do that
for
some stuff.
So what sort of things do you put in the smoker? You put things raw in the smoker or cooked in the smoker?
Mainly raw, and so what I've done. Actually, what I've done, because I can't control the temperature, it actually gets too hot. I have smoked things and then finished them in the oven, like a braise.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, especially something like a pork shoulder, I don't want to cook it at that high of a heat for that long in the smoker. So I'll get some smoke flavor from the smoker and then finish it in the oven and just braise.
Now, have you smoked your brats that way or your kielbasa?
The kielbasa I did that way, and it turned out pretty good, specifically because this was a recipe for a hot smoked thing. So a lot of those recipes are calling for cold smoke or you know, several different
stages.
So then
it's kind of cooking it already.
Oh, it's cooking it. So yeah, some of those you're just getting smoke in them and then they're curing, but they're never truly cooking to a temperature. Mm-hmm. But this one is definitely, it's cooking to, you're getting it to 160 degrees.
Yeah. I've got a brother out in Montana that for Christmas always sends me, well, he does elk and deer and things, and he has a smoker, and he sends me jerky, which is, you know, this stuff, it's smoked to make jerky, right? dried out that way?
There's a number of different – we can make jerky in the dehydrator. Yeah. I think the traditional way was to make it in the sun. So there's a number of different ways.
He's got the smoker thing, and I always look forward to that. What am I going to do with this? And I always end up nibbling away. It's a fine thing.
Is it venison?
Well, either elk or venison, and the deer out there are different than Iowa deer. They're a whole different thing.
Well, they eat a different diet.
They do. We're talking about grilling here and all the good. Oh, I'm getting hungry. I would just like to put a little taking from the sublime to the ridiculous. I am a great fan of, at the end of your grilling, whatever kind of fire, if we're even in a bonfire, I always like roasted marshmallows. It has nothing to do with the meat, but somehow that also at that charring of the sugar,
only slightly charring.
Well, yeah,
you
know,
I don't like them when they're flambéed black.
No.
Although
some people do.
Yeah, it's a popular option.
it's a lot of fun and it's dramatic. But no, I'm pretty picky. I like to turn my marshmallow tail.
Well, Lon is very good just with attention to detail. So,
yeah, just right. Yeah, okay. We're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you would like to hear more of this fine radio program, go to khoifm.org. We are on at noon, and we are repeated at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. And if you still can't get enough of us, go to khoifm.org. Find out lots of things about the radio station. Find out lots of things about this show.
And listen to us anytime you want.
Anytime you want. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Grilling. Nick, Evan, do you have any advice about rubs, marinades, barbecue sauce?
Well, when it comes to steak, I think you should let the meat speak for itself. And so just salt and pepper as far as seasonings, I think that's the way to go. But as far as sauces to go with it, I just made grilled grass-fed beef steaks, a chimichurri sauce, which is an Argentinian or Hawaiian type.
Give us the quick recipe you used. I happen to be a big fan of that myself.
Yeah, so exactly. And that's why I made it. So the traditional way, I think, is parsley, garlic, oregano, olive oil, a little bit of red pepper flakes, and salt.
Cilantro, I think, is...
Or cilantro. Uh-huh. So last night I made it with all cilantro because that was what was in the garden. And it was delicious. All cilantro, no parsley. So.
And it comes out very, like a thinnish kind of pesto.
Mm-hmm.
And very bright flavor. Serve it with the steak.
Just put a little spoon on the steak, and it goes really well because the steak's so fatty and rich and mm-hmm. savory, and that has a nice acidic bite to it.
Sounds good.
Yum.
Evan, do you have a favorite taste?
Well, you know, I kind of, I wing it every time I grill. I try to do something a little bit different every time. One thing that I would say that's really good to do when you're grilling chicken particularly is to brine the chicken before you toss it on the grill. So
That's true. Chicken can get a little boring. That's a great idea. So
exactly.
What do you put in your brine?
Basic brine, of course, is just some water, a bunch of salt, and a bunch of sugar. But depending on what I'm trying to do with my chicken, definitely some garlic. I like to do lime juice and cayenne if you're looking for kind of spicy south of the border kind of flavor.
Or vinegars also. Yeah. Something acidic is really
definitely.
Helpful.
Help that chicken
And then
along.
For the plain old barbecue sauce, I have to say I have a little trick. You just take, you know, because people like barbecue sauce. So I will buy a kind of a standard barbecue sauce, not too fussy, but I add fresh ginger juice or powder, but you kick the ginger up, and then a lot of minced fresh raw garlic. So you're kicking up the ginger and the garlic, and if you want it hotter, of course, you can put some more hot pepper of some sort. But just, I've never had anybody complain, you really hit the traditional barbecue sauce flavors, but they go, wow!
Ooh.
Wow.
That's the kind of reaction we like. Wow is good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's good. So what's on the menu coming up? Are there something you both want to try on the grill yet?
Yeah. Right. Beginning of summer. Where are we going?
Later this week? What?
Well, I have a lot of ducks in the freezer
ducks!
Still from last year. And I really need to get cooking those because next year's duck season is right around the corner. And
that's not your problem yet.
That's fantastic. All right. So we're looking for ducks. All right. Good. That sounds
now,
great.
Now, are you going to marinate those? Because if they're wild ducks, they're probably not too fatty.
Some of them are. Some of them aren't. But probably won't marinate them, but I'll always salt them beforehand. Maybe overnight. The brine is what really, I think
so
that's
you'll brine
the most important
them, then.
Thing. Brine them or dry or wet brine them, one of the two, but yeah.
You want to explain that distinction? So Evan described a wet brine. What do you call a dry brine?
Just taking some kosher salt and packing it all around the bird, and it basically it's a similar to a wet brine. It kind of liquefies on the surface of the bird, and it
do you put any seasonings in it, or you just do salt?
I would do seasonings afterwards. Because that's when the seasonings really come through is either when you started cooking it, after you started cooking it, or just serve a sauce.
Okay,
with
so
it.
Then what do? Brush the salt off before you grill it? What do you do with the dry? I'm not experienced with this wild duck stuff.
You might pat it dry, but usually, actually, what I do with lots of different meats is I salt it and then let it sit on a rack in the fridge, and that brining happens, but then the water that's accumulates on the surface evaporates off the top, so it's nice and dry on the outside so you can get a good sear on the so you don't have to cook out that water on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Very good. So,
and it's not too salty?
No, as long as you – I mean, unless you applied a brine multiple times, a dry brine, as long as you packed it, you could pack it all over and it wouldn't be too salty. If you did multiple applications or you brined it in a liquid that was too salty, then you might get over salty. But other than that, especially ducks or beef, which are pretty similar actually in the type of meat that they are, I don't think you can get it too
grained,
salty.
Yeah.
Red meat
red.
And some fat that's around.
External.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Evan?
Well, what I've been playing around with a lot more recently is doing kebabs on the grill. That's kind of a lot of fun for me because it gives you a lot of freedom to mix and match flavors. I mean, you know, you kind of take you take chunks of pretty much any type of meat that you want and intersperse them with veggies, maybe some chunked pineapple if you're into.
What's your most outrageous combination?
Oh, wow.
Because we know you get creative.
My most outrageous
that
combination. Oh, that worked. Well, you know, I have talked about doing tikka masala stuff in the past. I've done a chicken tikka masala skewer. So, you know,
okay,
you
now,
take
is that marinated with yogurt?
Yeah, marinated in a kind of yogurt sauce, then coated with kind of a creamy tomato sauce. Yeah, yep,
wait,
exactly.
Wait, then coated with what?
Kind of a creamy tomato sauce for
the
actual
cooking.
Sort of just toss the after you let your chicken sit in the yogurt and the curry sauce for a little while, you know, kind of marinate. Take it out, kind of take off the excess yogurt and toss it in your kind of creamy tomato sauce, and then you know toss it on the.
What do you mean by creamy tomato sauce? Do you put that all in the Cuisinart or something and blitz it up?
I usually do it on the stove personally, but, you know, let's stir it, thicken it, add a bunch of curry, add some garam masala. So that's your typical Indian spice blend. Then toss the chicken in that for a little bit, you know, just get it coated, put it on the skewer. I'll usually do slices, like really thick, like long side slices of like jalapeno. Do some onion, of course.
I hope you take the seeds out.
Oh, of course. But, I mean, you know, I like the heat a little bit, too. So,
now,
you know.
When you've got them on the grill, on the skewer, then are you brushing some more of the yogurt tomato sauce onto it as you go?
Yeah, brushing a little bit more of the tomato sauce on as you go. So sort of the base, again, of the chicken masala, the tikka masala. So.
Ooh, gentlemen. Yeah. This all sounds
tasty.
Really good.
Yeah.
Yes. Sounds good.
So we've got steaks, we got brats, we got sausage, ducks, kebabs, fish. Are you hungry yet? Three cheers for summer. And three cheers for all of you guys out there that like to grill.
Women can do this quite well.
Yes,
I also want you to know. But, you know, it's really fun to sit in the chair with the favorite beverage and stay out of the kitchen for
it is and we want to give a few thoughts to Father's Day coming up next week and thoughts on summer. June is traditionally a month for weddings, love, croon, June moon, that sort of thing, all that romance in the air, love. The reason young men become fathers in the first place. So there we go.
It's a good trick, I think.
We like to add a little taste of culture here on the Donalana Kitchen. Here's a poem. Take it away, Evan.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
A sonnet.
Thoughts of summer, yes, yes. Three cheers for fathers, three cheers for love. That was Bill Shakespeare there, If I Live and Breathe. Yes, it was. And I wanted to hear that one for the month of June, although it does start out with a little bit about the darling buds of May. It's a lovely, lovely bit of verbiage there. Do you have some thoughts on what Shakespeare has to tell us there, Evan?
Well, one of the funny things with Shakespeare, actually, is that his sonnets that sound very sweet and very very nice are actually kind of backhanded in a lot of ways. Whereas the ones that are very outwardly mean-sounding almost are really the ones that are the most loving, which I think is kind of funny. One of the great things about the way that Shakespeare uses the English language. This one in particular, though, is kind of interesting because, it starts out very, very loving. You know, shall I compare these to a summer day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Sounds very, very nice. But at the end, it kind of gives this implication that beauty fades, you know, so long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this as in the sonnet, and this gives life to thee. It's saying that, like, well, you're not going to be beautiful forever, but your beauty is captured in this particular sonnet, and like, hey, well, you might not be beautiful, but this poem still is, and it's sort of this backhanded remark, backhanded compliment.
Yeah, you're going to get old, you sweet young thing.
Right, right. And I mean, anytime poem is talking about the seasons, there's always this implication that, like, oh yes, you know, the summer is sort of the peak of your life and your appearance, your existence. But eventually, you're going to go and move on to the August and the winter of the autumn and the winter of your years, and you're not going to be so hot then anymore. Pun definitely intended.
Yeah,
on that happy note. Well, thank you, Evan. That was lovely. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Well, I shall. I shall. There's some things. There's an event coming up. We talked about the unfortunate demise of strawberries here in Central Iowa.
Short peony season, short strawberry season.
Oh, my. But
it was good while it lasted.
The Berry Patch Farm is having a field day this week. That's on Wednesday.
That's south of Nevada.
Yes.
There's a sign on Route 30.
Yes.
You can follow the sign.
Besides strawberries, which we missed, they're gone. The Berry Patch has 14 acres of strawberries, which are done, but they also have 10 acres of blueberries, raspberries, 6 acres of raspberries, 5 acres of apples, 2 acres of cherries, plums, and black raspberries, and 1 acre of currant and gooseberries.
They have red and black and white currants and gooseberries.
So there's lots of summer yet to come. Dean and Judy Henry and their son Mike and Matt Howison. Yes. They're out there doing good things. It's a UPIC place. It's a great place to visit.
It's a gorgeous place. It's a wonderful place to take your children.
Yes.
Or your grandparents or your father. It's
your father.
Just lovely.
Your father. So it's a practical Farmers of Iowa field day, Wednesday, June 14th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And besides all of the introduction to all these lovely berries, there's going to be a little workshop on the practice of summer pruning of apples and cherries. Dean Henry will tell you everything you need to know about.
If you have an apple tree in your yard, as many of us do, it's good to know how to prune. And boy, Judy and Dean have a lot of fruit experience.
Yes.
Should be really great fun. That's this Wednesday.
So if you want to know more about that, contact Deborah Buchholder at deborah@practicalfarmers.org or 515-232-5661. This field day is sponsored by Iowa Farmers Union, Nyman Ranch, and Wheatsfield Co-op. And contact Practical Farmers of Iowa for more information on that. Yes. We were in the studio today talking about grilling. We talked about Father's Day and Shakespeare with Nick Odie and Evan Taylor. The Donalana Kitchen comes to you every Tuesday at noon, repeated 7 o'clock in the evening or any time on your various listening devices at khoifm.org. Go to Talk, go to Donalana Kitchen, find archives there. And also, there's streaming of all the fine stuff you find on this radio station. We'll go out with a little music by the musician Norman Blake. And it's called You Are My Sunshine. You Are My Sunshine, a popular song. Matter of fact, it is the state song of the state of Louisiana. It was sung, made popular by the musician Jimmy Davis in 1939. And if you didn't think this song was popular, Jimmy Davis went on to be the governor of Louisiana a couple years later. So that's important there. Although he didn't probably write it, but nobody was keeping track of that thing back then. I think it was some people called the Rice Brothers in the early 1930s. I think that's where that comes from. So there you have it. There you have it. So we'll go out with Norman Blake singing You Are My Sunshine. KHOI has been on the air for a long time, almost five years. Yeah. There's a birthday party coming up. Stay tuned. Thanks for lending us your ears. This is the Donalana Kitchen. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Evan Taylor. And good food and recipe information by Nick Odie and Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy.